Hello and welcome to Worlds Apart. The conflict in Ukraine has already made military history as this century's most intense kinetic encounter between two large regular armies, turning upside down previously held truisms about the nature of war and the nature of peace. Is it still cheaper or more profitable to keep it going rather than trying to settle the disagreements that sparked it in the first place? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Jeffrey Roberts, Emeritus Professor of History at University College Cork. Professor Roberts, it's always a great pleasure talking to you. Double thank you for making it into our studio. Thank you for being here.
Well, it's good to see you again, and so soon after our last encounter in Sochi.
Well, we had a different topic for conversation back then, but in some way, you know, everything is related, everything is connected, and here we are again discussing this time Russia's contemporary history and the history of its disagreements with the West. And in one of your articles, or rather in many of your articles, you've been expressing a preference for a negotiated and to the war in Ukraine. Do you think the time is right at this point?
Yeah, I think now is may actually be the last time, the last possibility in the coming weeks and months to actually arrive at some kind of a peace settlement. If it doesn't happen, then maybe there will be no there'll be no peace settlement. There'll be some kind of forever war or forever conflict. And okay, so presumably at some point the fighting will stop, but it will stop without an agreement. And I think that would be a terrible situation, most of all for Ukraine, because in this war, it's the Ukrainian people that have suffered the most. Hundreds of thousands of them been killed. Country has been devastated. You know, their future existence as an independent sovereign state is at stake. I hope that it will be possible to find our way to some kind of ceasefire and peace agreement. But obviously that's just a hope. I mean, being realistic about it, the chances are that that actually won't happen.
Now, despite the fact that they are the most suffering side, the Ukrainians are still proclaiming their desire to fight indefinitely, but I think there have been some indicators, including an increasing number of publications in American policy and popular press, that Washington is sort of tending the ground for some kind, as you said, some kind of a ceasefire that would suspend the violence, but without addressing the major disagreements at the core of this conflict, the disagreements over security between Russia and the West. Do you think that will do it? Do you think that would be enough? Simply to end hostilities without settling those issues.
I think it's also important to say it's not just Ukraine that has suffered. Russia has also suffered from this war. Many tens of thousands of Russian soldiers have been killed. You know, it's had a devastating effect on the pro-Russian population of eastern and southern Ukraine. And Russia has incentives. Russia is winning the war, but it has a number of incentives to actually bring the war to a close as soon as possible. But yeah, okay, but going back to your question, yeah, there is a more realistic discussion developing in the West on the back of, you know, the failure of this so-called Ukrainian counteroffensive. It's become increasingly clear that Russia is winning the war, that the only outcome of the war is going to be some kind of Russian victory. It may not be a pure victory by any means, but Russia will win, Ukraine will lose. The longer the war goes on, the more Ukraine is going to suffer. There's no prospect of Ukrainian victory.
So, Professor Roberts, with all due respect, it's up to the Ukrainian leadership to take care of the Ukrainian people, Ukrainian soldiers, not up to Russia. And Russia went into this military operation as tragic and terrible as it may be, speaking as somebody who has Ukrainian roots. You know, Russia went into that operation having security prerogatives. And one of them, you've written about them extensively, is making sure that Ukraine is not turned into a military platform for attacking Russia. Yeah. Do you think Russia would agree to a ceasefire without this primary issue being addressed.
No, absolutely not. No, Russia will agree to a ceasefire that's linked to the outlines of a peace settlement, and fundamentally that peace settlement would include acceptance that the newly acquired oblasts in Ukraine remain part of Russia, that the security threat, NATO security threat towards Russia is lifted, and there are protections for pro-Russian Ukrainians that will remain within the Kiev-controlled territory. Yes, but I think Russia would accept some kind of a peace settlement on those terms. So, yeah, that for me, that's the biggest hope for peace in Ukraine, is that very definitely on one side, on the Russian side, there is a willingness to agree a compromise.
The United States is bankrolling this conflict, although the ability to do that actively is now being questioned by a new war. But still, do you think the Americans can be trusted, even if they trusted for a long term, if they consent to some sort of settlement on Ukraine?
Any ceasefire, any peace settlement is going to involve risks for both sides. And trust is a problem on both sides. And the only way to find out whether or not it's possible to trust the West in relation to some sort of peace settlement, peace deal, is to actually do it. And the same applies from the Western perspective. Mm-hmm. But we haven't quite got to that point yet. Yeah, I think Russia would be willing to negotiate a compromise peace. On the West, there's a lot of talk about the need to change Western strategy and maybe cut its losses, but there's no real, as far as I can see, at least politically, there's no inclination in the West to actually engage in serious peace talks with Russia, and certainly there certainly isn't any inclination on the part of the Ukrainians. Yeah, I mean, you said earlier it's up to the Ukrainians to look after their people, but the reality is that without Western support for Ukraine, this war will come to an end very, 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 very quickly indeed. So it's not just a Ukrainian decision. It's a Western decision as well. So it has to be, any peace dialogue will obviously involve the West, particularly the United States, as well as Ukraine.
Now, speaking about the Western involvement, not only as far as military support is concerned, but also sort of the guidance and the prodding of Ukrainian action. You've written in one of your articles that the much touted summer counteroffensive was done at the behest of Western military command, and that, you know, essentially what it achieved, a couple of villages at the cost of tens of thousands of lives for the Ukrainian army. And I wonder, I mean, for all the people who are concerned about the loss of life in Ukraine, is the life lost due to the poor Ukrainian command somehow less valuable than a life lost to, let's say, Russian aerial strike?
No, of course not. Of course not. But as far as your question about the failure of the Ukrainian counteroffensive, it was a failure that arises out of a series of illusions on the Western Ukrainian side. Illusions about their own strength, illusions about the strength of their Russian opponents, all kinds of notions that, Russian morale was very poor, that Russia had poor military leadership, that Putin was under pressure domestically, that Russia and Ukraine was a door that just had to be kicked in and the whole structure would come tumbling down. And those illusions have been shattered by the actual course, the complete failure of the Ukrainian summer counteroffensive, and as a result of that, there are some very agonising reappraisals going on in certain quarters in the Western policy community. But as of now, there's been no political shift. There are these experts having various discussions, making various proposals, but politically, by political leaders, I know no Western political leader who's indicated they want to change their policy on Ukraine.
But I mean, they haven't indicated that in rhetoric, but in some way, reality has indicated that for them, because we have another major war broken out in the Middle East, Israel, and it requires enormous support, and in strategic terms, it's you know, it's much more important for the West than, or at least for the United States, than Ukraine. How do you think it will change the course of events? Perhaps not even publicly. I mean, in terms of inner dynamics.
Well, it's obviously a distraction from the Ukraine war. It's obviously requires diversion of material resources as well. I think you're right. I think in the end, certainly as far as the United States is concerned, maybe not Europe. What happens in Israel, Palestine, in the Middle East is much more important than what happens in Ukraine. And obviously the Ukrainians understand this, that they sense this. And then their supporters in the West do. Their supporters in the West are constantly arguing, don't be distracted by Gaza. We're in for the long haul. We're in for a long war here. We need to double down on our commitment to Ukraine. But those kind of like hardline appeals are having less and less resonance. They're certainly not gaining any public support, public opinion in Europe and in the United States. And also, I think in Russia is moving, very steadily and decisively in favor of ending the war as soon as possible.
Well, because people want that budget be allocated into improving their own lives rather than sent somewhere with questionable results for indefinite time.
And they also want to see the slaughter in Ukraine stopped. They also want to see the existential threat of escalation, perhaps to the nuclear. They don't want that to be ended. They want, attention to refocus on, a whole series of common critical common global issues that we face to do with the environment, to do with medical issues, international terrorism, problems of migration, economic development, all these kind of issues which have been sidelined because of the focus on the war in Ukraine. So the sooner the war comes to an end, the better off it will be from many, many, many different points of view.
Let's talk about the sort of core reasons for this war, because American officials make it no secret that from their point of view, the underlying reason for this conflict in Ukraine is, from their side, the need to preserve the so-called rules-based order, which in Russian terms is the U.S.-centric economic and political system, which sometimes is also described as the American hegemony. And I want to ask you, as somebody who lives in the West, do you think that system in its current form, not historical form, but in its current form, with its current priorities, with its current methods, do you think it serves the interest and the underlying preferences of Western societies?
Obviously the West is fighting a proxy war with Russia in Ukraine, and it's not just on behalf of Ukrainians, it's on behalf of their own agenda, their own strategies. It's a war to weaken Russia, to end Russia's role as a great power. Preferably, they'd like to see regime change in Russia. But as you indicate, it's also a war to maintain what they see as their hegemony. Their so-called rules-based order.
But let's imagine they get what they want. Ukraine wins, Russia is defeated, Putin is driven out of power, and there is a puppet-like regime in the Kremlin. Would that solve Western problems?
Well, it depends what problems you're talking about. But look, I think it's important to understand the nature of the Western project of liberal global hegemony. It's actually much more radical than people think. It's not just about power and interests. It's about completely ending the system of the state sovereignty system.
But by trying to change it, they only make it better. Sure, it wasn't never a perfect system, but it's now much worse than the one they decided to make the world a better place.
Well, exactly. That's exactly the point. And of course, think about Russia and China and other countries. They're seeking to defend a system based on state sovereignty and based on the principle of non-interference in the internal affairs of states. The West, in its project to globalize their system, their values, their rules-based order, effectively they're seeking to destroy that traditional state system. So it's a very, very radical project. Mm-hmm. Yeah? And in a way, that's what one of the things that is possibly at stake in relation to the Ukrainian war. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's at stake because you're suggesting that, what if they win? I don't think they're going to win. What worries me is that they're going to lose. And how badly are they going to lose? How long are they going to prosecute?
Mm-hmm. And how radical they may be
in their response to failure and defeat.
Well, Professor Roberts, we have to stop for a second because we still have to abide by the rules of advertising. But we'll be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
La Banda Mazzotti non è un gruppo solamente musicale. La Banda Mazzotti è un gruppo di lavoratori, comunisti, che cerca di cambiare questa società. Il primo viaggio che abbiamo fatto con la carovana antifascista in Donbass era settembre del 2014.
Noi portiamo penne, matite, materiale per orfanotrofi e materiale per curare le persone nelle città, cosa che i nostri governi non fanno, inviano solamente bombe.
Ci siamo ritrovati ad andare in Palestina, in Siria, in Donbass, in moltissimi paesi, e ci siamo resi conto che eravamo forse l'unico gruppo musicale che andava là a sostenere una lotta, non a suonare.
Отверженных. Нам уже от нее не деться. Ветер степной пахнет смертью, мятой и медом. Мы пьем за любовь, за правду, за наше счастливое детство. Пьем, не чокаясь, из гильз от гранатомета.
Вся русская литература — это война. Поэзия там, где больно.
Победим, у нас нет других вариантов. Иначе эта вся свора размотает нас на тряпки. Так что нам придется побеждать.
There's no end in sight over how you're going to continue to destroy the earth.
Is the case of the madness of the people.
I tried to go to the gym, but I'm certainly not ready to fight Russia.
This is all so absurd.
This is third world lunacy. Brainwashing.
As Ursula von der Leyen likes to say, we have the tools.
Why don't we just start with stability and business deals?
And what planet are we living on now?
We have very good propaganda in our press here in Europe.
I think we don't know the aftermath.
Anytime that you're not allowed to ask questions, you should ask all of the questions.
The more questions asked, the better the answers will be.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Jeffrey Roberts, Emeritus Professor of History at University College Cork. Professor Roberts, before the break, you mentioned that the nature of the Western project is far more radical than it lets it be known. And I think Vladimir Putin sees it in even darker terms, because I think it was last year when he was addressing the Valdai Discussion Club, he accused Western leads of not only security encroachments and trying to remake the world in their image, but he also said that what the Western elites are trying to do is to try to change how people relate to culture, to history, free thought, free speech, their own bodies, social and familial ties. And I think it was a sort of a philosophical manifesto against this progressivist agenda, which, according to him at least, is out of touch, not just with core human values, but with core human nature. I wonder if, in this sense, the war in Ukraine is indeed an opening salvo in the very real clash of not just civilizations. I mean, this is the ultimate battle for what it means to be not just a state, but a human being.
Yeah, I'm inclined to describe the liberal project as a totalitarian project, actually. But having said that, it doesn't mean to say that I, you know, disapprove or disagree with many of the liberal values that it embodies. You know, I'm a liberal myself, so I agree with a lot of aspects of Western civilization, Western tradition and values, all kinds of things like that. It's just simply, I don't think that we can impose those values.
What's totalitarian about it? Because you're a
Stalin. As what Putin was, you quoted Putin to me there, what he was describing was a totalitarian project, a project to, you know, remake the whole world in your image. As to whether or not, the Ukraine is the touchstone of the success or failure of that project, I'm not so sure. It depends. It depends on how long the war goes on, and how it ends and when it ends. You know, if the war was to end tomorrow, for example, you know, the world would be pretty much, you know, like it was before the war started. Okay, there would have been changes. There were local impacts on Ukraine, Europe, changes in power dynamics, all kinds of things, but it would still be a recognizable world. If the war goes on, if, you know, the Western project gets, you know, it radicalizes itself even further in the face of defeat in Ukraine, then yeah, we could be looking at a very different world indeed.
Mm-hmm. But speaking about the nature of the world, even if we put the conflict between Russia and the West aside, it's pretty clear that the nature of international system is changing. And apart from Russia, let's say China, which are the most common targets of criticism or hatred in the West, there are many regional states that are rising, that are exerting their influence power in their immediate neighborhood. And by doing that, they are already indirectly challenging Western hegemony. And they do that not out of political or geopolitical reasons, but simply naturally. This is how humanity develops. I mean, this is impossible to change that. And the West no longer has enough resources to support their own populations, let alone make other countries play to its tune. And this is something that I don't realize, because in any confrontation, you have to do cost-benefit analysis. Sure, you know, there are ideologies that are, you know, sort of distorting your vision, but you are obligated to do the basic math.
Yeah,
are these people blind to what is happening around them? Because it's not just about Russia and China or Ukraine. It's about the whole world ultimately trying to stand up on its own feet, trying to provide for itself, trying to develop according to its own needs. How can you stop that?
Yeah, I don't think the world has changed as much as people think it has. I mean, as a result of the Ukraine war. I mean, the Ukraine war has catalyzed certain things, but there were pre-existing trends. So as a result of the Ukraine war, you know, it's a continuation of Russia's revival as a great power. China has become an even more major global power as a result of the war. And above all, you know, we have, you know, the rise of the so-called global South, which is what you were referring to. But, you know, the rise of the global South, you know, countries from that part of the world asserting their independence, trying to carve out a new
just
role.
Just trying to tend to their own interests.
Sure,
that's it, nothing more.
Yeah, but that's been going on since the 1950s. As yet, I don't see, you know, the war in Ukraine as a fundamentally, you know, transformative event as far as the nature of world politics is concerned. But, you know, my concern is that you know, it could lead to, you know, a fracturing, a split of the world political system into permanently conflicting, if not warring blocks. You know, the United Nations, you know, could break up. You know, it could be, you know, separate sets of institutions developed.
But to some extent, this has already happened, and thanks to Western-owned self-defeating moves. I mean, introducing economic pressure onto Russia, sanctions, and pressuring other countries. This already has led to the creation of alternative schemes of doing business, and surely if this trend continues, those schemes will strengthen.
Absolutely. If that trend continues, and it's a trend that might begin to engulf, you know, other parts of the world political system. Yeah, but I don't think we've got to the stage where, you know, the whole, you know, system of world politics that's been evolving in the West and then globally for the last several hundred years has actually broken up or disintegrated. There were certain, you know, indicators in that direction. But of course, interestingly, you know, Russia and China, which are, you know, often portrayed in the West as being like revisionist powers trying to grab world power, they're conservative powers, right? They're trying to preserve what is there, you know, because Putin is very strong. When he's asked about the future of the United Nations, he's very clear. clear, is that we don't want to get rid of the United Nations. We want to strengthen it. We want to reform it. We want to make it more effective. And the Chinese say the same thing. So in that way, there's a contest going on between what a friend of mine, Richard Safar, calls sovereign internationalism versus liberal. Global hegemony, liberal internationalism.
But Professor Roberts, I don't understand, why do we have to term it as a contest? If you develop your and live your own destiny, and I do the same in my life, why is it a contest? I mean,
I agree with you, but it is a contest.
Why?
Well, because those who favour global liberal hegemony are pursuing their goals, and it's coming.
Oh, because they're pursuing their goals by sucking up resources from the rest of the world. That's the only thing they're doing.
They're pursuing their goals in all kinds of different ways, and it's leading to conflict, including war. That's just a reality. I agree with you. There's no reason that should be the case. There's no reason why we can't have a multipolar pluralistic world of sovereign states and different civilizations.
And self-sufficient countries. Maybe,
but also, collaborating countries, interdependent countries. Yeah, why not? That would be my vision.
Collaborating when it's beneficial to them. And again, we've seen that over the last year and a half when many countries refuse to cut ties with Russia simply because, it goes against their own very cynical but material, but also, national interest, which is probably a good thing.
Yeah, but I think you have to be careful by saying, "Oh, we need self-sufficiency," and your focus on our national interests, our way of life, our civilization. But there's a danger in that attitude.
What?
The danger is that you're reinforcing the radicalism of the Western project. Yes, you're actually you're becoming part of the problem. Part of a divergence.
I'm arguing that you have to live within your own means, either as a human being or as a country, and the United States for many, many decades has been living off the world. And despite doing that, it is now more indebted, more politically polarized, more governmentally impotent than ever before. So the more resources it gets from the rest of the world, the weaker it gets on the inside. And I want to ask you, what do you think may possibly prompt the American public, the American society, the American elites to look inwards and tend to their own garden instead of trying to mess with everybody else who is actually doing the hard work of trying to develop their societies and provide for their people decent, dignified lives?
I think in one sense, there's a simple answer to that question. What will concentrate their minds, change their view, may precipitate change? It's a new Trump presidency. Trump, that's what might do. And in fact, going back to our discussion about Ukraine and changing Western perspectives on Ukraine, at least among some people, some experts, what they're really worried about, they're worried about the return of Trump. They're worried that Biden's going to lose the election. They think that how can Biden win the election with the United States fighting a losing proxy war with Russia in Ukraine? A new Trump administration could really shake things up. Now, you might think that would be a good thing, and perhaps it would be a good thing, but it would also bring a lot of dangers as well, because of course Trump talks big on lots of things, but he doesn't deliver. So, for example, he talked big about cooperation with Russia, détente with Russia, and partnership with Putin, and so on. But it was the Trump administration that actually started this problem in Ukraine by beginning the process of building up Ukraine as a NATO enclave on Russia's borders.
Let me ask you about this. I know that you have a somewhat controversial position about what would solve this conflict, and this is potentially Ukraine's membership in NATO, or rather NATO membership for what is left of Ukraine. Yeah. Why do you think that could be a workable solution? Because this is something that I'm not sure the Kremlin...
Any negotiated peace settlement, if there's going to be a negotiated peace settlement, maybe there won't be, will involve some kind of Western guarantee of Ukraine's future security and independence. Yeah. So my view is actually the best, the safest guarantee from a Russian point of view would be some form of NATO membership for Ukraine or some kind of association with Ukraine. Okay, that there would be all kinds of
So essentially what you're saying, the West takes full responsibility for the reconstruction, rebuilding of Ukraine, providing it with the reasonable security infrastructure.
And also takes full responsibility that Ukraine will stick to its side of the peace
settlement. Can the West promise that?
Well, okay.
Can it actually deliver what it promises, if it promises?
The only way to find out that impressive, I suppose my fundamental point is, Russia, President Putin didn't go to war just for the sake of symbols, the symbol of Ukraine becoming a member of NATO. That wasn't the thing. The thing was an actual military threat to Russia in the form of a NATO military build-up on Russia's borders. Once that problem is resolved, the outcome of the war and in terms of peace settlement, then I see no reason why Russia won't acquiesce in Ukraine becoming a leader of NATO. And I think Russia is fortunate to have a leader, President Putin, who I think has the states, is the kind of statesman who can actually grasp at that kind of quite radical solution. And also, of course, he has the power and political popularity to deliver such a peace settlement.
Well, it's at first glance, it sounds very provocative to a Russian ear, but I think the last year and a half has demonstrated that NATO is a paper tiger because, regardless of what they say about their military capacity, their ability to muster industrial production to provide armaments for Ukraine has been very limited. So perhaps it's not as scary as Russia envisaged it to be a year and a half.
Well, I think it's probably going too far to describe NATO as a paper tiger, but certainly, of course, Russia, in just purely military terms, has it's surpassed the West in virtually every country.
And it has a battlefield experience that the West no longer has.
Absolutely. Yeah. In the West, I like to talk about, it's been a costly war for Russia, it's weakened Russia. It certainly has been a costly war for Russia, but actually, Russia is emerging from this conflict, or will emerge from this conflict, much, much stronger than it was before the war.
Let's leave it here. It's been amazing talking to you again. Thank you very much for coming over.
Thank you for the invitation.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.